Well, good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We'll open our meeting this morning with a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists and then a presentation of the announcements. Now, these can be found on the periodical statement at the usher's table. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In keeping in line with this declaration of principles, which unites all United Lodge of Theosophist centers around the world, here in Philadelphia, we hold a few weekly activities, and we might end add that rather than just as independent devotion is the privilege of the individual student and associate, it's also the privilege and responsibility of each center to independently figure out what is the best way for them to fulfill the statements of this pledge of ULT, because each in themselves determines through their own effort, their own inner determination, what they will do, independent devotion. So all are welcome to participate. There is no obligation imposed or implied in terms of contributions of time, service, or money, all of which are left up to the individual, and of course, all of which is needed. Now, our activities here, then, are conducted purely on a voluntary basis with the assistance of students and associates through the years. So, on Sunday mornings throughout the winter season, we have a series of panels or forum talks, each of which allow plenty of time for questions and answers. Beginning this month, we have a specific series of Sunday morning topics, which we'll discuss in a few minutes. And then on Wednesday evenings from 7:45 to 9 p.m., we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. Right now, we are on chapters dealing with reincarnation, and starting this Wednesday, we will begin to look at reincarnation from the point of view of what it explains, the mysteries of life that it explains. And of course, this Wednesday we'll be taking up the subject of how reincarnation explains differences due to character. We just wanted to add also that our meeting on Sundays start at 11 o'clock in the morning and go to 12 noon. In addition to these two weekly meetings, there is a book table in the center of the building on the first floor, upon which are displayed straight line original theosophical literature, books, pamphlets, magazines. They're all available at the cost of publication and shipping. There is no profit to be made from the sale of these books. All contributions made to the lodge are used primarily to keep the building open and to furnish heat in the winter and air conditioning and light when necessary. So, in addition, there is a library available on the first floor. The library hours are 5:30 till 7:30 on Wednesday evenings, just before the class. The library is a reference library. It's not a lending library, and it's meant to assist students in their individual studies. So there will always be the subject material for the particular Wednesday evening class available there, the part to be studied, any references. And as well, there is a variety of books from fields of science, art, religion, philosophy, history, which complement and round out a theosophical education. So, having gone through those announcements, we'll bring it back to the particular subject for this coming month on Sundays. And as said, we have an umbrella theme called Masterworks of Theosophical Masterworks of Modern Theosophy. And we might want to mention that theosophy is the name given to an age-old accumulated body of wisdom called the wisdom religion, which is as old as thinking humanity. And but in each age, the presentation of it may have had a different name, but it's still the same doctrines fundamentally. And so by modern theosophy, we're referring to the works put forth in literature through the writings of H.P. Blavatsky. And there are four of them that we're going to look at this month, and they're called masterworks in one sense because they are the most influential even to this day of her writings. Today we take up Isis Unveiled, next Sunday The Secret Doctrine, the following week, The Key to Theosophy, and the final week in February, The Voice of the Silence. Now, this is a project that has never been attempted here in ULT, but we think it's very important. And so many of us as students are going to do our best to summarize in a few minutes what really takes a lifetime to understand, even in its basic ideas. So we certainly are not trying to exhaust the subject, but maybe just give an inclination as to why these works are important, why they're worth your own individual investment of time and effort in studying them. So today then, the other aspect of that word masterworks, it's not really a pun, but it has a double meaning. All these literary efforts she said were not her original or her own ideas, but rather that they were the teachings given to her by the Fraternity of Depths or Elder Brothers or perfected human beings who have been the custodians of this ancient wisdom down through the ages and periodically give it out through one of their agents. And in that time, throughout 1875 to 1891, when she was actively writing, the works she put out were very much assisted by these adepts in the way they were written and in much of the information provided. So that's the twofold meaning of this word, masterworks. So today we are going to look first at what is unveiled in Isis Unveiled. And this is a panel format, so we're going to have about a 10-minute presentation on that aspect. And then we're going to go into, in the second panel presentation, also some in a little bit more detail, what are the specific ideas that were brought out in ISIS and Baal, particularly to the West, for the first time. So, what is unveiled in ISIS Unveiled is the challenging question for today. But even before we attempt to answer that question, there are a few other basic questions we need to get out of the way so we can appreciate the answer to that final question. Why was it written? Now, it was written, or published, rather, we should say, in 1877. Its first edition of 10,000 books sold out in a few weeks, and it has never been out of print since. So it is one of the enduring masterpieces of literature, and at that time was singularly praised by scholars as well as the press. So, and it is still available today. So the name is ISIS Unveiled, A Master Key to the Mysteries of Ancient and Modern Science and Theology. Now, the actual book we call ISIS Unveiled, the second part is a subtitle. So we learn later from HPB that there are actually seven keys to the mysteries of man and nature, and only one of those keys is given in ISIS Unveiled. So what is revealed is only a partial aspect of the wisdom. These keys are provided periodically, as we said, by the Lodge of Adepts, who are the custodians of literature, in the same way a teacher or a parent might gradually unfold their knowledge and wisdom to a child or to a student, not to overload them. So it's given according to the need of the individual and their ability to assimilate and understand it, not to confuse them, not to mislead them, not to give them too much that they can't handle. And it's the same thing. They hold it, not exclusively for their own, but they hold it for us, preserve it in our pure form, so it can be given out when it can be appropriately used and appreciated by humanity. And so these keys are given out according to our need, and we are given quite clearly what these needs are. She says at the very beginning that the author dedicates these volumes to the Theosophical Society, which was founded at New York, 1875, to study the subjects on which they treat. And as we understand, they treat of science and theology. And therefore, they deal with what they call the second and third object of the Theosophical Society or the Theosophical Movement. The second being the investigation of the different sciences, religions, and philosophies, Eastern and Western, ancient and modern, in order to get an appreciation of the underlying value. And that value is to see the underlying unity of all those disciplines. And the third object is to investigate the occult or hidden powers in man and nature. So that's the scientific aspect, the second being the philosophical and religious aspect of the work. The first object of the Theosophical Movement is to establish the nucleus of universal brotherhood founded on the spiritual identity of all beings. And so we'll come to that aspect of it, of ISIS, and where it contributes there. But so that was first. And then the second was, she points out in her book, and we still recognize this today, that neither the theories of science and the dogmas of religion, especially at that time, were inadequate to explain what was already known about the tremendous powers of human beings and about what was spoken about in the ancient philosophies and religions throughout all time regarding the origin of man, nature, destiny, potential powers, things that have been displayed and documented all around the world by scientists, by researchers, by the church, and missionaries and mystics all over the world. Yet there were no teachings, there was no foundation in the science of religion to explain them. And so the work is addressed to the needs of the open-minded and inquiring mind of that time, as well as the mind of today, which is open-minded and curious about these things. So the work is, she's very clear about her audience. The work is addressed to those who are searching, She even says those who should not study the book, and those who, if they study the book, might find themselves violently opposed to it. So she was well aware of her audience and their needs. And she said that she had to deal with the mind of the race, the mind of humanity at the time, in our times. So she does not give us anything that we have to depend on by blind faith or authority. Everything is laid out. The arguments are given, evidence is given, the citations are given. They're given to our judgment. Everything is left up to us to examine, to figure out if it's reasonable, to figure out the facts are accurate. But the overwhelming evidence, she says, points to the certain conclusions that the open-minded person would have to assume. That's the tone of the book. So in terms of that first object, we think we can best understand why she wanted to put it out, and we're going to quote her from The Isis Unveiled because the words could not be expressed more elegantly. Deeply sensible of the titanic struggle that is now in progress between materialism and the spiritual aspirations of mankind, our constant endeavor has been to gather into our several chapters like weapons into armories every fact and argument that can be used to aid the latter in defeating the former. Unless its growth is arrested, it may become our master. Our voice is raised for spiritual freedom and our plea made for the enfranchisement from all tyranny, whether of science or theology. The second question we want to look at is, how was it written? And we want to back up and say that in the earlier year part of the year, in 1875, HPB wrote a letter to a Professor Corson who was with Cornell University. And he was one of the most important professors at the time, very well known as a writer and a researcher in English literature. And she wrote to him this note in a letter. The indications are that we are on the threshold of an epoch when 1,000 mysteries shall be revealed, and it depends at least in some degree upon such very feeble moral agencies as your pen and mine, that those and those of other zealous workers, how soon the world shall be enlightened. Corson was very much interested in fascinated by HPB, and invited her to stay a few weeks at his home in Ithaca. And so his son, we have a letter, and the information was later confirmed by writings of Dr. Corson, about HPB while she was there. And his son says that she spent her time at her desk writing most of the day and way into the night. Here she started Isis Unveiled, writing about 25 closely written pages a day. She had no books to consult. My father's extensive library was almost wholly an English literature, and she rarely consulted him about anything. Professor Corson later confirms this by saying, she had a profound knowledge of everything, quoting long verbatim paragraphs from dozens of books, of which I am perfectly certain there were no copies at that time in America, translating easily from several languages. She herself told me that she wrote them down as they appeared to her eyes on another plane of objective existence, that she clearly saw the page of the book and the quotation she needed and simply translated what she saw into English. So later, she left there after a few weeks, went back to New York and worked with Colonel Olcott in New York. And he writes that one day in the summer of 1875, HPB showed me some sheets of manuscript she had written and said, I wrote this last night by order. And we understand that, as HPB says later, that she was giving out she says this later in her books, every word of information found in this work or any other writings comes from the teachings of our Eastern masters, and that many of the pages in these works have been dictated to me under have been given to me under their dictation. In addition, Olcott says that she explained to him that she had the ability and demonstrated that ability to read into the astral light, which is something we can talk about later. So we need to understand that, and also in that work on her books, she gives some interesting facts which impress us even more about the way she was helped in these books. When she came to America in 1873, she had not spoken English for over 30 years. She had learned it in her childhood. She could understand when she read it, but she could hardly speak the language. She had never been to college, was not a scholar in science or philosophy, and until 1874, she had never written any word in English, nor had published any work in any language. So the point is that she had assistance not only from others, such as Olcott and the masters, her writings, though, in terms of their eloquence that we can find and have been compared to some of the most elegant authors in the history of the English language. So obviously for someone who just learned to write English the year before, she had to have a lot of help. So the final, the veil of, we wanted to read about the title a little bit, the Isis Unveiled. This was not the original name of the book. If we look through her, have access to her original documents, at the top of every page that she had handwritten was a title called The Veil of Isis. And she took it from a well-known inscription, which is the base of a very well-known statue of Isis. And the inscription of the base of the statue of Isis was, "I am all that has been, all that is, all that ever shall be, and no mortal has ever lifted my veil." So she preferred the title, The Veil of Isis, because it was never her intention and she never claimed to unveil all the mysteries of Isis or give out all that secret information. She was to point to the veil by a way in which we could begin to maybe understand what is man, what is his destiny, what is his origin, what is his powers. These are really big mysteries. But the publisher said it would be better to use the term Isis Unveiled, since there was another book at the time called The Veil of Isis. So now we come to our lead-in to the second presentation, What is Unveiled, and basically three points we want to make before we go into the details. First point, there has always existed from the remotest times a system of thought whose teachings in regard to man and nature are complete and leave nothing out, that this body of wisdom has been in the possession of masters or adepts, wise beings down through the ages, and portions of it are periodically given out, and it predates and is the basis of all the ancient philosophies, religions, and sciences. And that if we examine all them, as she does, we can see their underlying unity and origin. She called this the wisdom religion, and that the portion that was being given out in her writings publicly, again, was called theosophy. So we'll stop here and let our co-worker and student go into more detail.
So in Isis, really what she's addressing at the time is issues concerning the materialistic view of both scientists and the materialistic view of religionists, which often some people would say, well, how could you consider religion materialist? And we could get into that in the question and answer. But the one of the objectives of Isis is to lay out certain tenets of the ancient wisdom religion, which would open people's minds to view science and theology from a different basis, to better and more clearly understand it, and to work through the dogmas of religion and the limitations of just materialistic science. Some of the tenets that she laid down to accomplish this are that, in fact, spiritual man pre-existed, that the soul is not created with each new body. And it preexisted in an ethereal body, depending on the conditions of the earth at the time. It could, you know, our last life recently obviously would have been material, but prior to that, it was an ethereal body. And she gives an incredible antiquity to the human race, and talks about their various coats of skin. In Genesis, we hear that God bestowed upon Adam and Eve a coat of skin when they were thrown out of the Garden of Eden. That actually has to do with the evolution of the form. She says, also, we should bear in mind that cycles do not affect all of mankind all at the same time. And this explains the rise and fall of civilizations. It also explains why and how we can have wealthy countries with educated masses alongside of other poverty-stricken countries with them. You know, on the one hand, the personal views of the time often are, is it grounded in selfishness? Well, there's a lot of compassion and a lot we can do about that, but at the same time, everything occurs under the law of cycles and of karma, cause and effect. She speaks to the spiritual and the intellectual and the physical evolution of the universe, not just the physical evolution. She talks about the doctrine of metempsychosis, among which lower orders of evolution are declared to have emanated from higher orders of evolution and then began to develop. If we study the doctrine of metempsychosis, it will answer certain questions regarding the immortality of spirit and the indestructibility of matter. She says that the ancients knew far more concerning certain sciences than our scientists, even the geniuses, may know today. And that among them is that magic is as old as man and was considered a divine science. That being considered, it's helpful to think of the ideas, the Hermetic phrase, as above, so below, or that man is, in fact, a microcosm of the macrocosm. From the first ages of man, fundamental truths of all that we are permitted to know on earth was in the safekeeping of the adepts. And that behind all of the different religions, modern and ancient, was one common teaching kept protected and distributed as appropriate by one fraternity of adepts that had one common brotherhood throughout the entire world. So, if we take the time to study Isis, it may bring a conviction to us that everything is governed by law, impersonal law. Nobody gets any special preferences because you're a part of a particular group or because there's any certain special thing. Everybody has to do the work themselves, and everything that comes to us is according to the law of cycles and karma. So, that being considered, she lays out 10 propositions, 10 propositions of the Oriental philosophy, the first of which is that there is no miracle. Everything that occurs, occurs under law. Now, there may be things that occur, and we don't understand the laws behind what's going on, but there is no miracle per se. Second is that nature is triune. There is the outward, physical, objective form of the universe, and there is the indwelling, electromagnetic, vital model, exact model of that form. And third, above that, there is spirit, which is the force of all, of the source of all forces. The first two, the physical and the model, the electromagnetic model for the physical, are, they change. They change over time. But the third does not change. Similarly, man is also triune. He has his objective physical body. He has his vitalizing body or soul, which is the model for the physical body, which we also call the real man. And then there's the sovereign, the immortal spirit within man. When the real man, the inner man, succeeds in merging himself with spirit, he becomes an immortal entity. Magic as a science is the knowledge of these principles and of the way by which the individual may acquire control over nature's forces while still in the body. Magic as an art is the application of these principles. And arcane knowledge misapplied is sorcery. When it's beneficently used, it is true wisdom. Then she talks also about mediums and explains the difference between mediums and adepts. A medium is the opposite of an adept. A medium is an individual. He or she is passive and is controlled or ruled and allows foreign forces to operate within or through the medium. The medium is typically not conscious of what's going on, and in particular, he or she does not have control. However, the adept actively controls himself and all the inferior potencies around him. All things, past, present, and future, have their record upon the astral light, which is also called the tablet of the unseen universe. And an adept can read that astral light and can know all that has been known and all that can be known. She also speaks to the races of men that differ among their spiritual gifts, as well as their stature, physical stature, color, etc. And among many people, different races of men, seership naturally prevails, and among others, mediumship prevails. One phase of magical skill is the voluntary and conscious withdrawal of the inner man or the astral form from the outer man, his physical body. Among mediums, this is done unconsciously, involuntarily, and without control. But with the adept, it is controlled. And she says that actually the abandonment of the living body by the soul frequently occurs, and such living corpses may be encountered every day. Finally, the cornerstone of magic is an intimate, practical knowledge of magnetism and electricity, their qualities, correlations, and potencies. Especially necessary is a familiarity with their effects in and upon the animal kingdom and man. And so to sum it up, magic is spiritual wisdom. Nature is the material ally and pupil of the magician. One common vital principle pervades all things, and this is controlled by the human will. So, for the rest of the meeting, we would invite contributions. We're sure some people have contributions and questions. Yes.
A medium is passive, was stated. We came across, I believe, in the Key of Theosophy, talks about mediatorship. What is that? Is that similar to mediumship, or is that something different?
What's the difference between? So we talked about mediumship and adeptship, and adept controls everything. So what is this mediator? There are certain circumstances where an individual will allow an adept, a higher disembodied human, to use their vehicle for a higher purpose, and it's under specific certain conditions. And when that happens, so unfortunately, people who are not familiar with this would assume, well, that person's a medium. No, that's not true. Because when that does happen, the person who is allowing it is conscious of what's going on and can stop it at any time. And it is our understanding that in the production of Isis Unveiled and the Secret Doctrine, this happened at certain points with HPB. But it's not to be inferred that she went into some kind of a passive trance and just turned herself over, because that's not what happened.
Mm-hmm. We might understand that also by analogy with ourselves, because we understand that we are all on some higher plane interconnected, but even on the material plane, we share the same air and water and atoms and who knows, we probably share the same electrical frequencies and we're bombarded by the cell phone frequencies of each other, and the electric tower frequencies. So we are constantly being bombarded and influenced by foreign tendencies that we don't really understand or are aware of all the time. And these can affect us physically and psychologically. In that sense, we are all mediums in the sense we live in the medium of life. So it's really a question of degree, how passive we are. So when we are absorbing any material, we are listening passively to it, the TV or radio or a movie, without using our skills of discrimination and judgment. If we are being swept along by the arguments and of a demagogue or a leader who knows how to exert influence over a crowd, if we fall influenced to our, allow ourselves to fall influences to our lower passions and sensations all the time, in that extent, we're to a certain degree mediumistic. But that can be certainly extended to the point where one begins to display certain psychic faculties which are not under control. But at the same time, we understand that we can learn to control those influences, our passions and desires and the things we watch and the things we read, and put them to a special purpose. And that's when we become mediators. We take the influences and we channel them the way we want to, rather than letting them work indiscriminately through us.
Yes.
I think I brought this up at a former meeting. You know, Dr. Hawking, probably one of the most brilliant physicists, every time I hear him, he keeps saying that the afterlife is just a fantasy. It doesn't exist. When the brain stops, we're finished. That seems to be in direct contradiction from what I hear you all saying. Can anybody speak to that a little bit? He's so brilliant, you kind of wonder how could he get it wrong. Mm-hmm. But I think he does have it wrong. Mm-hmm.
Well, we think he's brilliant, but we don't think he said he was infallible.
Okay.
So he's brilliant in the context of his own particular investigations. But if we look at his conclusions and compare them with the accumulated testimony, even though the testimony we have today by other brilliant people, other brilliant physicians and sciences, and individuals who have personally gone through conditions, scientists, neurosurgeons who have personally gone through conditions where their bodies and brains have been declared dead, and they witnessed consciously what went on around them and reported it back in detail. So are we going to say that one person, because they're brilliant, everything they say is right, and another person who's brilliant, everything they say is wrong? No, we have to assert our own brilliance and take these ideas and realize that we also have the ability to judge and know, to weigh the facts and evidence and come to conclusions independent and not influenced by the dogmas of science or religion or theology. And that's what she says, to be spiritually free, to free ourselves from the dogmatism of theology as well as science.
She also mentions in Isis that, if we consider a gentleman like Dr. Hawking, as brilliant as he is, as logical probably as he is, we have to be careful, she says, because the more that we develop reason, unless we're doing it right and maintaining balance, our reason will completely overshadow our intuition. And if it's we can't know that side of nature with our logical mind. We also need to develop the intuition. Yes, in the back.
Well, we use the terminology, but do we understand what is meant by a thinker and the process of thinking and how we learn to think?
Well, we'll take the first part. What do we mean by the word thinker? Here in theosophy, often we use the word ego, capital E-G-O, not ego like Freud, but ego. And in English, some people think that was invented by theosophy, but it's not. It's an English word, which simply means, in a philosophical sense, that part of man which experiences. That is the ego. Nothing else, just the experiencer. So the ego is comprised of spirit, soul, spiritual soul, and mind. And that is the true man. When we talked about the immortal man, that is the true man. Spirit, spiritual, soul, and mind, all as one. Now, how we think, we're going to leave it to the next speaker.
How do we think? Well, I don't think we have to learn how to think. If we are thinkers, we are naturally endowed with the power of thought. And if, as thinkers, we are one in our spiritual essence with that universal aspect of soul and spirit that guides the universe, then we are intuitively gifted with not only the ability to think, but to know the thought through, know what's true through our own self-induced and self-devised effort, and figure out things that to us appear self-evident. That's the intuition. But in a sense, we may need to learn how to critically think and evaluate the propositions that come to them, because we are, in a sense, mediumistic. As we are young children, we absorb and from our parents and our teachers and our culture all ideas. We take these in and we say, I believe, I think, but none of us really sat down to figure out if this is really ours, when really we just went into a store and just picked up whatever was there and took it on as our own thought and never questioned it. So theosophy invites us to think about what we think, to realize that we are the thinker as separate from the thoughts and ideas we hold, and begin to check them to see if they are reasonable. Because as Plato says, ideas rule the world. According to the ideas we hold, that determines not only our character and our destiny, but the world around us. So it's one of the people that HPB says that might find these difficult ideas, difficulties, are the free thinkers, who find that we do not accept what they do, but demand recognition of the whole truth. So being a open-minded and free thinker does not mean you indiscriminately accept whatever is put forward to you, but have to acknowledge the whole truth of the situation, to examine it from all its points of view. And it's interesting that HPB, several years later, went back and wrote a critical review of Isis Unveiled, in an article called My Books, where she took it apart for its weaknesses and strengths. And she says in there, you know, the publishers told me not to do it because it would be bad for sales. Sounds typical, publishers. But she said, since I did not write it other than as a commitment to the expression of the whole truth about these ideas, my devotion to truth, we have to tell the truth about this book. And she points out the difficulties and the challenges, where it's brilliant, where it's true, and where it needed to be corrected and things made as she went along and did other writings. So that's the kind of thinking we need to develop, to be open-minded and yet critically evaluate the truth of what's being presented to us.
Yes, in the back.
That reasoning faculty takes a lot of work to reason out something. But that intuitive nature that we have and we feel and we know, it just comes. We don't have to question, we don't have to balance it, we don't have to weigh it. It just comes and we know. That's a vast difference from that reasoning.
So we're comparing and contrasting, you know, intuition versus reasoning. And for sure, in certain situations, such as, you know, mom just knows whether or not such and such were her children, and dad sits back and doesn't get involved if he has a different opinion in certain at certain times because of that mother's intuition. And that's the same, you know, we can use our intuition, you know, daily for major decisions and even minor decisions. The challenge that comes when we're using our intuition, and it's not a reason to not use the intuition, but the challenge that comes is trying to discern, is that my spiritual intuition or is that my personal stuff that I just kind of want to make happen for me? Which is, and we think the only way really to find out is do it.
So to follow up on that, it was previously mentioned that the real man or the real thinker, the inner human being, is a composite of spirit, spiritual soul, or buddhi in Sanskrit, and mind, the thinker. So that buddhi then represents the storehouse of, or accumulated wisdom and experience that the thinker has been through countless experiences and lives. It's that storehouse. And so what comes through to us as intuition are more or less clear glimpses of that accumulated experience. But it has to come through a vehicle. It has to come through an instrument. And like a guitar or piano or violin, that instrument can be in tune or out of tune. And what tunes it or puts it out of tune in harmony with the higher part of our nature is the way we think and feel. So as these intuitions come through, just like the light from the sun can come through red or green glasses, it gets colored, it gets distorted. And so even our intuitions, while we have them, we have to check, test, and verify them with the accumulated experience of the ages, with the intuitions of others, with our own reason and judgment, with the facts in nature. In other words, we need to use all our powers and capacities of mind, not just develop any one of them to the exclusion of the other. The problem is, as said, is the more we get involved in the brain and developing the capacities of the pure intellect and reason, not only do we become cut off from that clear insight of our intuition, but we also get more cut off from the divine compassion and love that's within that higher nature of ourselves. So the purely intellect can not only be materialistic, but also very selfish and cold, unless it's harmonized with the higher.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, good.
Oh, I wanted to speak about one of the things that you said, which is that the PB, she said that thousands of people will realize what she are talking about. And it seems like talking with words such as masters and secrets, and it's like, seems like the knowledge was held by fewer, and now it's trying to be disseminated more. Is that something that is on? Is that why these publications are coming out? Because I guess why I'm saying is because the word secrets, it's like this is knowledge that only few used to have, but now it seems like it wants to get out.
We think of that question will be more definitely answered, and we invite you all to come back next week when the subject is what's secret about the secret doctrine, because she says there that she's in that secret doctrine, not to steal the thunder of any student, but that she's not presenting anything new, kind of a challenge there, but rather bringing together, like a nosegay of flowers, the accumulated wisdom, which has been recorded. But there are some specific things that are given out for the first time, and they'll be covered. But the point is, yes, the knowledge has always been held in the hands of a few, because those few, by their own efforts, earned the right to be the bearers. They could be trusted, just like none of you would entrust your most cherished loved ones and your most cherished possessions to just anyone, but to those that you knew and you knew would protect, and you know, you would secret or confine that cherishable gift for your future posterity with those that proved themselves. Well, they do the same, but not for the preserving of their own wealth, but preserving the accumulated wealth and privilege that belongs to all of humanity. So that's why we say this knowledge is available. We don't make a profit off the sale of these books, but they have to be produced. So they're all given out because it's the expression, it's the human birthright to have access to this knowledge. But it's given out periodically in cycles according to the readiness of the minds of those particular people in that particular part of the world, in that particular culture, that particular time. And so in the mid to late 1800s, humanity at point had reached an era, as HPB said in her letter to Corson, where the time was ripe that certain secrets could be given out. And it all depended, how quickly it was given out would depend on two things. The work that was done by the disseminators of it, the propagators of it, and the readiness and the way at which it was absorbed and applied by those who received it. So in that sense, it seems to be more available at this time.
Another thing to bear in mind, when we talk about philosophy and religion and we hear the word secret in philosophy and religion, it can be helpful to replace that with the word sacred, because the two are very close and they have a common etymology. The reason why so many ideas are held secret is because they are sacred. And the dissemination of one small piece of theosophy to people who are not ready for it can have the effect, if they're not educated in the system, of thinking that theosophists are not humble because the theosophists view that God is within every human being, and actually that there is the personal God in the higher human being. And to some people who don't appreciate that, we're talking centuries ago, that could end up, you know, that could end the theosophists up burning at the stake, you see? And so, you know, Western civilization came finally to a point in the 1800s. Think of where they were in the 17th, 16th, and 1500s. Finally, by the 1800s, they were ready for ideas to be disseminated that were just impossible to safely disseminate since, you know, the times of Alexandria.
One more point to finish up on this. The HPB in the Secret Doctrine and other places says that the man we know as Jesus the Christ, or the Christ, was an adept who came with a specific mission at a specific time to a certain people. And if we go what he said in his writings that we have available, he didn't write it down, but what his disciples said, he said, made two statements we want to keep in mind. He said, cast not your pearls before swine. And he also said to his disciples, unto thee I reveal the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, and to the masses I give parables. So he gave out publicly what he could in terms of stories to help the average human being perfect and develop the best they could their higher qualities. But for those who are ready, his most trusted disciples, he gave more.
Yes. What we heard, we used to read, came along when books were number one for getting information. And we read about a certain inventor who couldn't solve a problem. And we think the word was, I was sleeping on it. And it tells you right in the book, he climbed up on his lap table, went to sleep, and when he woke up, he had the answer to his problem. That's something that we seldom do, because we use the computer.
Well, we wouldn't be the first to say that in some ways the computer has been a great boon to us and also a curse, because we know children and various individuals where before they might have developed a lot of outside relationships and social skills very often become too often glued and fascinated with the social media. Not to discount the value of social media, but obviously there needs to be a balance. So we spoke of a theosophical education. The purpose of a theosophical education is to give us a working knowledge of that accumulated wisdom, those fundamental principles that can be found in all philosophies and religions so they can be our universal tutor. We can carry them and guide them in our understanding of whatever we come to in life and how to respond to it. But we can maintain that balance of the universals with the particulars of our life.
Yes, there's a question here.
In several parts of ISIS, there are historical accounts of things happening which you do not find in your history books or anywhere in fact. Like, for instance, there was a sect in southern France that were Gnostics. And within that community, they had those beings who had perfected themselves to an extent where they could see into that unseen world. But the Catholic Church came and killed every one of them, every last one of them. Mm-hmm. And you can go to southern France and you see markers with their name on it, but nothing was left, just because their ideas that they held were against the ideas of the Church. Now, what that conjures up in one's mind is that the brutality of life, of our religious institutions and so forth. What is the safeguard in theosophy that theosophy won't become like all other religions, brutal and dogmatic and unsympathetic?
So what is the safeguard in theosophy that it won't crystallize and become dogmatic? Well, for sure, if we're studying these ideas, and today we've gotten a little deeper, into certain things than often we do, for sure, one can expect, all of your studying to come to nothing if you don't have the right motive to studying it. Because unless our motive is to be of service to others and bear in mind the fact of universal brotherhood, and use these ideas simply to grow in certain ways so that we can more clearly understand, have a greater conviction, and act and think from a basis of universal brotherhood, it's just not going to work. It's there's a lot of power behind the ideas that are found in theosophical books, but the misdirection of without having the right basis and the right motive for studying it, nature has a way of putting the trap door in so that you really can't get that far and hurt too many people with it.
And H.P. wrote, when she wrote about the objects, there's a fourth one, which sort of comes under the others, so it's not always, but she definitely states it, and that is that the fourth object is to oppose all forms of dogmatism and that kind of authority. So it's as part of the effort to maintain the truth as to well as oppose obstacles of truth. So it's not just a passive goodness, but it requires an active will on the part of individuals, students, to follow those purposes.
Okay. Oh, so that our hour is up. So thank you for coming. Our we also have a meeting at 7:45 on Wednesday night. We're continuing our study in the Ocean of Theosophy, Reincarnation, and then next week will be another study in the What is Secret in the Secret Doctrine. Thank you for coming.
Good start. Did I do it right? I just pressed it off. Yeah.